You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 13th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, The Rise of the Warrior Cop. Huffington Post writer and author Radley Balco will be here. Also, are we seeing a sea change, maybe a lake change, a river change in policing in this country? The Department of Justice saying they will not pursue mandatory sentencing for nonviolent drug offenses. Stop and frisk falls, or at least the way that New York City does it. And when does outside and independent mean not really that outside and not really that independent? It's when President Obama announces an independent technical review group of the NSA surveillance. Also on the program today, Cory Booker, just one more reason not to vote for him if you've yet to vote in New Jersey. North Carolina passes the most draconian voter ID. It's the new poll tax, ladies and gentlemen, North Carolina. Deficit, its lowest point in 5 years. And why college education grows more. We've got data to support that, a point that I've been making for months now, ladies and gentlemen, which is not to suggest there was no data behind it now, but someone put it into one tiny little article. But before we get to any of those stories or our interview with Radley Balco, who I should say is, I think, one of the first libertarians we're going to have on the program, with whom at least much of what he argues in his book I agree with. Not all, but enough, I think, that I feel like the topic warrants important discussion. But on another topic of equal importance, today is August 13th, 2013, and that means that today, Michael, from our staff, turns 18 years old today. Good.
Is that the Chipmunks?
Yes, your favorite band.
Yes, I appreciate it.
Happy birthday.
That's right. It's Michael's birthday. Anticipate many happy birthday phone calls and IMs during the better half of the program. And, of course, probably two or three members quitting. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Radley Balco. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Huffington Post writer and author of Rise of the Warrior Cop, Radley Balco. Radley, welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So, all right, Radley, let's start. Give us a little bit of a historical context. When did the cop start to rise to becoming a warrior?
Well, I think it goes back to the late 60s, actually. I started to experience some civil unrest in the U.S. And really the precipitating incident was probably the Watts riots in 1965 in L.A. The inspector at the LAPD at the time, who later became police chief, Daryl Gates, was in charge of LAPD's reaction to the riots. And he was alarmed that he thought the department didn't really have an adequate way of responding to these kinds of, you know, emergency situations where you had lives at immediate risk and, you know, active shooters or riots, hostage takings, you know, emergency type situations. So he came up with this idea to turn to the military, and the military had these, you know, special forces type teams that could respond quickly, who were, you know, elite, highly trained, specialized, and could use, you know, you would use overwhelming force to quickly defuse a violent situation. So we put together this team, and he called it a SWAT team, and he. Initially, the response from LAPD was interesting. They actually did not, Chief William Parker did not like the idea. He said it tread too close to breaching the line between domestic police and the military that we've traditionally respected in the U.S. And it wasn't really until a new chief took over that Gates got the green light to go ahead with this idea. There were a couple of high-profile raids, one on the Black Panthers, one on the Symbionese Liberation Army, that were nationally televised. And that really kind of propelled this idea of the SWAT team into the popular culture. And by the mid-1970s, pretty much every large city in the country had one. The thing about the 70s, though, in the early, you know, the first decade or so of SWAT is that they were always reserved for these kinds of emergency situations where you're using violence to defuse an already violent situation, and you're saving lives that are at immediate risk. It's really in the 1980s that we start to see SWAT teams converge with the drug war, and we start to see a massive, massive increase in the use of SWAT, mostly to serve warrants on people suspected of drug crimes. And, you know, here you're using violence, or you're actually creating violence where there was none before. You're not using violence to, you know, de-escalate something, you know, an already violent situation. And you're using SWAT actually as an investigative tool. You know, before SWAT teams were used against people who, you know, were in the process of committing crimes, so there's no question about their guilt. But in the 80s, 90s, and, you know, up until today, SWAT is overwhelmingly used against people who, you know, not only haven't been convicted of any crime, but haven't even been charged, and the police are still in the evidence-gathering stage of their investigation. And that's really where, you know, I think most of my criticism in the book comes. It's not an anti-SWAT book or an anti-cop book even. It looks at the policies that really were behind this shift from using SWAT in emergency situations to using them more proactively and as an investigative tool.
And it seems to me, too, that the sort of the culture around SWAT, if you can call it that, has sort of bled into the police department. I mean, I remember in the early 80s, in my hometown, Massachusetts, having some SWAT guy come to our classroom or something, and the idea of SWAT was just very, it seemed, compartmentalized, that it was a very specific group of police who are on the force, who had access to the gear and had access to the training. And it seems on some level that sort of I don't want to call it a firewall, but it seems like that wall has sort of maybe in some respects just disappeared totally.
Yeah, and I think that's the larger story here, is that this culture of militarization has bled out beyond the SWAT teams, and it's really affected a lot of police departments across the country in a more widespread way. And I mean, you know, it isn't just the paramilitary tactics, but it's also a mindset. You know, along with the explosion of the number and use of SWAT teams, we've seen, you know, politicians that constantly told police officers that they're fighting wars on drugs, on crime, you know, on terrorism. And, you know, a lot of police departments have switched from the traditional police blues to what they call BDUs or battle dress uniforms. They've adopted a more military look. And you can see this in, you know, the way that police officers approach their jobs. If you take a cop and you put him in, you know, a soldier's clothing and give him a soldier's weapons and train him in a soldier's tactics and then send him out on the streets and tell him he's fighting a war, that's going to have, you know, an impact on the way he approaches his jobs and the way he approaches his job and the way he interacts with the community that he serves.
Tell us a little bit about what that impact is when the rubber meets the road, because I think that dynamic of, you know, you start dressing someone like a member of a paramilitary organization, they're going to start to feel like they're a member of a paramilitary organization. I mean, what are the implications of that in terms of policing?
Yeah, well, I mean, in addition to just the, you know, the explosion in the number of SWAT teams, but I think, you know, you see it in a lot of, if you go to police discussion boards online, you know, you'll see a lot of iterations of a phrase basically to the effect of, I'll do whatever I have to do to get home safely at night. And that's a battlefield mentality, right? I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get home safe. That's a far cry from protect and serve or keep the peace. Police officers are told every day that their job is, you know, extremely dangerous and getting more dangerous. And in fact, you know, it's certainly a more dangerous job than mine, which is the journalist, but the job is not, I mean, it's usually not in the top 15 or 20 most dangerous jobs in the country. And in fact, if you take out car accidents, the odds of a police officer being killed, murdered on the job are about the same as being murdered simply by living in most large cities in the U.S. So, you know, this isn't to diminish the fact that some police officers are actually killed on the job. But the problem with this is that, you know, the job has actually also been getting safer, I should add. Last year was the safest year for police officers since the early 1960s. And so the problem with this is that you tell police officers every day that, you know, their job is extremely dangerous and every interaction with a citizen could be their last. You encourage them to start seeing citizens as threats and every citizen as a potential threat and the person who, you know, may be the one who prevents them from going home that night. And that really fosters an antagonistic relationship, again, between cops and the community. You know, you see this with the Stop Snitching movement that's kind of bubbled up in a number of cities. And, you know, whatever you think of that movement, and I understand people who find it, you know, repugnant, the idea that people won't cooperate with police even in a murder investigation, for example, you do have to understand the sentiment behind it. And it's pretty remarkable that there are entire, you know, communities in this country where the residents of those communities fear the police more than they fear the people the police are supposed to be protecting them from. And I think we need to look at, you know, why that is. And you can blame it on hip-hop culture if you want. But, you know, I think there is something more kind of fundamental at stake. And I think it goes back to, again, this shift in policing that we've seen over the last generation or so.
So was it, I mean, I know that you really focus on the drug war as being sort of the catalyst, or I should say the fuel that that was added to the sort of fire that had begun in terms of creating SWAT teams. Just outline for us sort of how that how the drug war evolved and what laws that came in that sort of followed, I guess, on a parallel track, or maybe one that sort of drove this change in police culture.
Yes, yeah, so, you know, the drug war began in the Nixon administration, and when he declared war on drugs. But you know, the SWAT phenomenon was basically sort of being born at the same time. But as you said, the two trends sort of moved parallel to one another throughout the 1970s. Nixon, you know, did pass policies like the no-knock raid, but it was applied to basically federal narcotics cops, basically cops who are, you know, in street clothes or in, you know, some sort of uniform, and these weren't SWAT teams that were conducting these raids early on. It was really during the Reagan administration that we see the use of SWAT teams for drug raids take off, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, you know, Reagan really kind of blurred the line between police and military. He, you know, brought in the National Guard to start fighting the drug war. At one point, he even tried to bring active duty troops in to start conducting searches and making arrests. That was one of the few bad ideas, actually, that didn't become policy during the 1980s. But, you know, he created these joint task forces that encouraged cooperation between the military and police and domestic police for drug interdiction efforts. And then he started to make military equipment available to police departments across the country. And this, you know, this is a policy that's continued ever since. And what we've seen is literally millions of pieces of equipment that was designed for use on a battlefield has been given to domestic police for use on American streets and American neighborhoods and against American citizens. You know, we're talking tanks and armored personnel carriers and helicopters and guns and bayonets. And, you know, this has been going on for, you know, 35 years now. There's never really been any, you know, public debate or public discussion about whether it's appropriate. The other thing that Reagan began that has continued ever since is he created these federal anti-drug grants. And, you know, we have a history in this country of determining criminal justice and law enforcement policy, leaving it to local officials to decide. So they, you know, they decide what laws are going to be a priority, and they, you know, enforce laws in a way that reflect community standards and community values and community expectations. And it really began with Nixon, but what we saw during Reagan, and again, has continued ever since, is more heavily federal influence and in local policing. And basically the way they've done this is through these grants. And, you know, when the federal government starts making, you know, free money available to police departments, attaches, you know, rules or requirements that, you know, in order to get this money, you have to do more drug policing or these grants are only going to go toward drug policing. So you have to make so many drug arrests or confiscate so much, like a minimum quantity of illicit drugs in order to get these grants. But now, you know, drug policing becomes a much higher priority. And so you've got all this gear that you got for free. So you start a SWAT team. Now you can keep the SWAT team in reserve for and wait for one of these emergency type situations, you know, that SWAT teams are created for. Or you can start sending your SWAT team out on drug raids now, and there's all this money that comes with that, and now your SWAT team can actually start generating revenue for the police department. So it wasn't a difficult decision for a lot of police agencies. And this is really how we see SWAT teams start to be routinely used to serve drug warrants or search warrants in drug cases.
Talk about how these drug cases can actually generate revenue for a police department.
Well, you've got the federal grants that I mentioned that only go to drug policing. So if you send your SWAT team out to arrest a suspected murderer, there's no federal money that comes with that. If you send them out to raid, you know, a couple of people suspected of dealing or you know, smoking pot and make the arrest, there's federal money that is attached to that. But then there's also asset forfeiture, which is this policy, civil asset forfeiture, which says that, you know, if you raid a place and you can make even a loose connection between any cash or, you know, a car or a house and any kind of drug activity, the police can then seize that property. And it's up to the property's owner now to prove that they earned the property legitimately. And you basically have to prove a negative. And, you know, the property owner actually never even needs to be charged with a crime. And if the police are able to, if the owner can't prove that he earned it legitimately, and if you think about all the things you own and you're asked to prove that you bought them or owned them legitimately, how difficult that would be, the police department gets to keep it and the revenue goes back to the department. And this is almost always tied to drug cases. There are some other crimes that forfeiture comes with, but it's mostly drug cases. So again, here's another incentive, you know, to send your SWAT team out on these drug raids.
And how much also did the war on terror add to this? Because it seems to me that there was just a tremendous amount of money that was earmarked for homeland security, as it were. Which again, it's one of those situations where And what's interesting is that, I mean, is this money necessarily earmarked to buy equipment, or is it up to the discretion of police departments as to whether or not they can simply add a couple of police officers? I mean, I know that, and you give Clinton some praise in the book for the community policing programs, and rightfully criticism for other aspects that he expanded under his presidency. Mm-hmm. But how much discretion, particularly when it comes to all this terrorism funds, is there for the police departments to say hire another cop as opposed to getting an armored personnel carrier?
Well, we're talking about a couple different programs here, and the community policing program that was started during the Clinton administration, I praise the intent of the program in the book, but actually its effect was fairly pernicious, and you touched on the problem, which is that there's no oversight with these grants. How they get spent once the check leaves the federal government is up to the individual police departments. And so, you know, community policing is this idea that cops should have a stake in their communities, and, you know, they should walk beats and be a part of the communities that they serve instead of this, you know, kind of occupying force, basically. And it's a good, I mean, it's a more effective, better approach to policing. The problem is, again, there was no oversight. And so a couple of investigations actually found that some police agencies were taking this money for community policing and using it to start SWAT teams, which is sort of the very opposite of community policing. And in fact, a criminologist, Peter Kraska, the criminologist at Eastern Kentucky University, did some surveys of police departments and actually found a lot of police sheriffs and police chiefs actually considered SWAT teams and more active SWAT teams a part of a community policing strategy, which was not at all the intent of the grants or, you know, of the Clinton administration when they started it. So, you know, the problem is with the oversight. You talk about the anti-terror grants. And this is what we see after September 11th. We see the Department of Homeland Security start sending these checks out to police departments across the country to buy military gear. And again, you know, the grants are, some of them are earmarked specifically for, you know, to hire more cops or to do this report security. But what we are seeing is a lot of these grants are going specifically to buy military-type gear. Armored personnel carriers, for example, or, you know, more powerful weapons, guns and weapons for police agencies. And, you know, the problem with this is that if you go back to the Pentagon program, the Pentagon giveaways, you know, that was all equipment that already existed. You know, it was sitting in a warehouse somewhere. These DHS grants are going to buy new equipment, which means they've given rise to a cottage industry now that has sprung up to serve basically just to cash these DHS grants and produce this new battle-grade equipment. And so you've got this industry now that is wholly reliant on these grants. And, you know, inevitably, they're going to open a lobbying office in D.C. and lobby to make sure that these programs continue and expand. And, you know, it's all going to sort of start to feed off of itself. And now you've created what you might call a police industrial complex, a little brother of the military industrial complex. And the scary thing about that is, you know, once that's all in place and up and rolling, it's going to be really difficult to roll any of this back.
And so, I mean, I don't want to jump too ahead because I want to talk about what the implications are for this. I don't want to say that. The question here is then, could this move and what is problematic about the sort of the police setting themselves up in a much more adversarial role to the community than they should? And I think we can see that. I mean, it seems to me that we can see that manifested in a couple of areas. I mean, you know, even a program like Stop and Frisk, at least how it's been implemented in New York. Would you see that as something that has emanated out of the culture that has grown up around that it's an offshoot of this culture that has grown up around policing?
Well, sure, yeah. And, you know, I mean, part of the problem there, too, is that you have these police officers who are from outside the community coming into these communities, usually, you know, communities of color, and, you know, basically harassing people. I mean, there was just an article today about a guy who had been stopped and frisked over 50 times, and, you know, had never actually been charged with a crime. Apparently, he just looks suspicious. I mean, I think that is part of it. Although, you know, stop and frisk is also at heart, it's a gun control program. So it plays, I think, to some progressive, misguided progressive ideas on law and order, as well as conservative ideas on law and order. I definitely think that's part of it. And it's, you know, it creates a very antagonistic relationship between police and citizens. And I mean, you know, at the very heart of stop and frisk is this idea that, you know, everybody is a potential threat. Anybody could be carrying a gun. Therefore, the police should be stopping and searching anyone who looks the least bit suspicious. And, you know, New Yorker or, you know, Bloomberg and Kelly would argue that it's made New York safe. I don't know, you know, crime has dropped across the country over the same period, including in cities that didn't use stop and frisk. So the idea that that's behind a New York crime drop, I think, you know, flies in the face of a lot of other evidence.
How much do you see? I mean, we also have, I mean, particularly in New York, but I imagine as well across the country, a convergence of sort of the national security state in terms of spying, particularly out of the New York Police Department, working hand in hand with, I don't even know if I could call this guy a CIA liaison. He was sort of pulling two paychecks simultaneously. But we know the stories of the New York Police Department spying on Muslim students throughout the Northeast and beyond. Where do you fit that into your thesis here?
Well, I mean, you know, the government does have a national security is a legitimate function of the government. But I do think we need to be very careful of what's going on here. I mean, you know, it's telling that if you remember, right after the September 11th attacks, the following February during the Super Bowl, the White House, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, aired these commercials that basically attempted to tie casual drug use, pot use, to terrorism. And this was a very, it was completely intentional. And, you know, the government right off the bat was trying to tie the drug war to the war on terror, of course, because terrorism was the thing that people were most afraid of at the time. And so we've seen this kind of conflation of these two issues, you know, ever since. The BBC and the Washington Post have both done long series on, I think Time has too, on, you know, how our anti-drug interdiction efforts in Afghanistan are, you know, harming the war on terror, because we're sending soldiers out there to burn opium fields while, you know, farmers watch as, you know, U.S. troops set their livelihood aflame. And it's, you know, hurting our relations over there, and it's hurting our ability to actually find terrorists. And you see this, you know, all across public policy. With this NSA stuff, I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, we learned that the DEA was trying to get its hands on all this NSA data in order to launch drug investigations. So we got to be very careful about this, because, I mean, even if you, and I have lots of problems with the NYPD spying programs and the CIA infiltration, all of that. But, you know, even if you do support that as a legitimate function of government, it very, very quickly bleeds over into more routine sorts of law enforcement. I think we should be wary of what's going on for its own sake, but also we should, you know, understand that once government gets these sorts of powers, even if it's in the context of, you know, limiting it to national security, it isn't long before it finds other excuses to use it as well.
And one of those examples, I think, of that that bleed too is the response to the Occupy movements, at least in New York and in certainly other cities across the country. You've got I think people can remember the sight of sort of these RoboCop cops, you know, storming a public park, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that's also part of what is problematic, is that, again, this is bleed over, right? I mean, it's a mission creep in some respects.
Yeah, and this is another separate narrative that goes through the book, is the way government responds to protests And it goes back to the WTO protest in Seattle in 1999 and the way the city responded to those protests, which was, you know, the city basically came out expecting confrontation. You know, the cops came out in their RoboCop or Darth Vader gear, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, I interviewed the chief of police of Seattle at the time, Norm Stamper, in the book. And, you know, he thought, you know, it was better to be overprepared and prepare for confrontation than to regret not being prepared. And to some extent, he was right. But, you know, there's a better way to handle that. And I also interviewed Jerry Wilson, who was the police chief in D.C. in the early 70s, you know, during a period of a lot of civil unrest in this country, particularly in D.C., and he took a very different approach. Wilson said, you know, he would always put his uniformed cops on the front line, the guys in their traditional police blues. In fact, he would sometimes go out on the front line. And, you know, he said you'd have your riot squad ready and you have to be prepared. But he said he would put them on buses and park them off on side streets because his approach was, or his philosophy was, again, if you go into a protest expecting confrontation, then that's what you're going to get. And when the police show up, you know, dressed like that, both they and the protesters are starting from a point of, you know, something bad is about to happen. And, you know, Stamper, to his credit today, he says his response to those protests in Seattle were the biggest mistake of his career. Because he said he's seen how that has become the template, that's how every city now responds to protests. And he said he actually said it breaks his heart, that he was, you know, he sees himself as responsible for that. And, you know, I mean, the inherent irony here is that, you know, the more important the event, you know, the more influential the decision makers, the more consequential the decisions they're going to be making, the more likely it is that the protesters are going to be put as far away from the event as possible. And that's, you know, that's pretty much the opposite of what the First Amendment is supposed to be all about. You know, it's supposed to be about being able to be heard and being able to have your complaints, you know, heard by the people who are making the decisions. And we seem to have, you know, this way we respond to protest seems to be in direct contravention of, you know, everything the First Amendment is supposed to be about.
Wilson's an interesting character because he also resisted the no-knock raids as well, right? I mean,
right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is a policy that Nixon, this is one of Nixon's sort of pet policies that he pushed through in 1970. And, you know, the interesting thing about the no-knock raid is that it wasn't something that police chiefs were clamoring for. It wasn't something that criminologists were saying we should have. It was basically the idea of a 28-year-old Senate staffer who was looking for issues that Nixon could use in the 68 campaign to basically exploit suburban white fears about black urban crime. And so they came up with this idea of, well, you know, cops should be able to, you know, break down people's doors without knocking. And, you know, if they're suspected of drug crimes, then we need to get tough on them. And so Nixon pushed this through, and there were two bills. One applied to federal narcotics officers across the country. The other applied just to D.C. because Congress has jurisdiction over Washington, D.C., so just the drug police in D.C., and Wilson didn't want it. He said, you know, we don't need this. It's intrusive. It violates, you know, civil rights, civil liberties, and it's just not necessary. He said, you know, we can do drug policing without kicking down people's doors in the middle of the night. An interesting thing is that, you know, a lot of other states passed no-knock bills similar to the Nixon bill, and, of course, the federal agents were using it left and right across the country. And D.C. refused, and crime actually went down in D.C. While Nixon was president, while it went up in the rest of the country. Now, you know, I don't think Jerry Wilson's refusal to use no-knock raids is the reason why crime went down in D.C. But I think more broadly, his approach to policing, which is a more community-oriented approach where, you know, he had cops out walking beats. He strove to recruit police officers from within the city so that, you know, there were people who were a part of the communities they were policing and grew up in those communities. And it really seemed to, you know, to have an effect. The other interesting thing about the no-knock bills is that the federal bill passed. And as I said, you know, federal narcotics officers were kicking down doors left and right after this bill passed. But there were a few cases where they got the wrong house that became national news. And the New York Times did an investigation, the AP did an investigation, And they found actually dozens and dozens of these of instances where these federal narcs had, you know, kicked down the wrong door, raided houses without a warrant, you know, terrorized people. There were a few deaths. And really a fascinating thing happened, which is a Congress held hearing, and they brought in the victims of these raids to testify. And they actually repealed both laws. Not only that, they passed another law that made the federal government liable for any botched, you know, raids on the wrong house. And, you know, it was a time, it showed that, you know, even in the height of Nixon's, you know, drug war and all of his, you know, kind of dehumanizing of, drug offenders, that Congress was still capable of some shame and of, you know, being able to reflect and decide that maybe this particular policy had gone too far. The no-knock raid would then, you know, then comes back in the 1980s with a vengeance. And we, you know, we've seen hundreds and hundreds of these no-knock raids on the wrong house and innocent people getting killed, and, you know, Congress hasn't given it a second thought. And so it was a kind of a little blip in history. I was actually really surprised when I found it in my research. I had no idea that that had happened.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, is this a story? Because we also have, I think, over that time as well, over the past 30 years, the Supreme Court sort of loosening the restrictions on the requirements for protecting civil liberties, particularly in terms of, well, in addition, I should say, in terms of police work. I mean, so do we have, you know, because I think there is a natural tendency. I mean, going back in another life, I was in a situation where I played a cop on the streets of New York, and I was wearing the uniform for a week on the streets of New York City, basically without much oversight. And I'll tell you what, it certainly dramatically changed my attitude. I found myself jaywalking and stopping cars and telling bike messengers to get off the street. I mean, I can only imagine when you have that. I think back to that time and how radically it changed sort of my perspective on just what was happening around me. And interviews that I did with police officers in the run-up to the RNC in 2004 in New York City, and they were being told that this was going to be like Seattle times 10, and there were going to be anarchists in here and they were really sort of worked up into a fervor of like, this is going to be a war, and we've got to get into these trenches. So on one hand, we have, I think, a culture that is susceptible to this type of thing. We have had programs that have sort of played into that culture, but you've cited examples of times where we've seen the federal government pull back on that. What is the solution here to this? I mean, how do we redirect police departments around the country from being sort of quasi-military or outfits to going back to a more integrated sense of their role in the community?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, I guess. You know, I think there are a number of specific policies that we could repeal that would help. And one is, you know, these giveaways of military equipment, the checks to buy more military equipment, the incentives, the federal grants that go strictly toward drug policing. And, you know, let's go back to letting crime policy be decided on a more local level without all of these influences and incentives. You know, I think what you'd find is that police would devote a lot more time to solving crimes with, you know, actual victims than, you know, crimes where all the parties consent, like a drug crime, for example.
But let me ask you this. In terms of like the locality, I mean, it seems to me that we have localities that could go one way or another. I mean, you cite Wilson and his policing as being radically different than a guy like Gates, let's say. Could we also just say, you know what, instead of giving you these funds for buying new gear, we're going to give you these funds to adding cops to your force? And so you can feel the security of having numbers on some level. It doesn't necessarily have to be in terms of firepower.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with that with the federal grants, though, is that money is fungible, and, you know, you can give the other department money to hire more cops, and then they can, you know, they can take whatever money they were going to use to hire cops, and move that to, you know, more aggressive policing. You know, I do see your point about how, you know, I don't think we can completely leave policy up to the local level. I think, you know, I think we need a very robust civil rights division within the Department of Justice. I mean, I think local police agencies should be able to dictate, you know, what laws are going to make a priority and, you know, what policing strategies are going to use. That said, you know, they have to protect people's civil rights and civil liberties. And so I think the Department of Justice needs to do, and actually Obama's been a little better than Bush on this, although I still think it could be a lot better. I mean, that should be a priority of the Justice Department, is making sure that police departments and prosecutors for that matter are observing people's civil rights and civil liberties and not abusing them. But you know, I mean, in terms of specific policies or even just kind of attitude changes, you know, I think in general, I think the community aspects of policing need to be more emphasized, and the, you know, kind of kicking ass and taking names aspects need to be de-emphasized. You know, talking about in the book, if you look at police recruiting videos, the videos that they send out to high schools and colleges to get new cops, you know, the images are typically cops, you know, rappelling out of helicopters and tackling people and kicking down doors and shooting at people. And, you know, that's the very first step in the process, right? You are appealing to people who look at those images and think, that's what I want to do every day. And of course, you know, that's not what cops should be doing every day. You know, the aspects of policing are much more, that we want to emphasize, are much more mundane. And so if you go back to high school and think back to people you went to high school with who, you know, would find a job, involving those activities appealing, I think, you know, most of the time you would decide that that's one of the last people you want to become a police officer. So, you know, really de-emphasizing that stuff. But, you know, you talked about the power you felt when you were a cop in New York. I mean,
I was actually playing a cop, but yeah, go ahead.
Oh, when you're playing a cop, okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's even a more powerful testament to this. I mean, you know, if you look at the Stanford prison experiments, for example, where, you know, back in the 70s, this professor, you know, got a random group of students and assigned one to be prison guards and the other to be prisoners, and they ended up having to suspend the experiment after just a few days because the guards started abusing the prisoners. And actually, he played the role of the warden, and he found even himself, you know, taking a very antagonistic view toward the prisoners. And these were completely randomly assigned roles. If you look at the Milgram experiments, where, you know, these volunteers were asked to administer electric shocks to people, and, you know, they weren't actually shocks, but the actors on the other end were, you know, screaming in agony, and the volunteers were told to keep giving the shocks, and they continued to give them. I mean, this kind of stuff should be taught at police academies. I mean, police officers need to be aware of what that kind of power can do to your psychology and the way that you view other people. And, you know, I think too often we emphasize the threat that police officers face. We emphasize the dangers of the job, but we don't teach enough to police officers about what that kind of power can do to you emotionally and do to your psychology. So, I mean, that stuff needs to be taught at police academies, and I think it needs to be, you know, retaught often. A few months ago, I had lunch with a guy who teaches use of force classes to police agencies across the country. And he said one thing he's found in the last 10 or 15 years that he finds really disturbing is that a lot of these courses, you know, not the ones he teaches, but that he's observed, they don't talk so much. There's very little emphasis on de-escalation now. There's very little emphasis on, you know, how to talk your way out, how to talk somebody down. Because, you know, a lot of these classes now focus on how to justify whatever force you've used after you've used it. So basically how to write a police report that, you know, exonerates you for whatever force you've just used. And that's really kind of telling. I mean, that we've gone, you know, that even the training has gone away from preventing police violence to finding ways to justify it after the fact. And so this is all, you know, this is all sort of cultural stuff that I think needs to be changed. And that's a very difficult thing to do. But, you know, I think, again, it starts with policy, and it starts with, you know, electing public officials who understand these things and that, you know, who are going to implement policies that, you know, emphasize the right aspects of police work.
And this may be, I mean, I think, you know, this may be where, you know, sort of the ideological perspectives on which we approach this sort of diverge on some level, because, you know, I mean, it seems to me counting on police departments around the country on their own, with the hopes that in each of those police departments that we find in each locality are going to have this level of, I mean, maybe it's too grandiose a word of saying enlightenment, seems to me far more far-fetched than simply saying on a federal level, if we can incentivize people to buy more gear by giving them money and setting up a system of incentives to do this. I mean, you say that, you know, that that federal funding is fungible, but that means that on the local level, they're making the decision to make it that fungible. It seems to me there's got to be a mechanism coming out of Congress and where we can have a focal point of saying in a broader sense that culturally speaking, we want a different culture of police work in this country, and then incentivizing and providing the funds to gear training towards that, to gear hiring and expenditures on a local level in that manner. I mean, obviously, you're not going to have the feds run every police department, but if the federal government can incentivize through the drug war and through anti-terrorism policies too much sort of buffing up of these police departments, it seems they could also do the reverse, yeah?
Well, in theory they could, but, I mean, if you look at who in Congress is going to stand up and say we should give our police departments less money to fight the war on terror or to fight the war on drugs? I mean, you know, I point out in the book that, you know, at the federal level, I mean, this has been a bipartisan rush to insanity. I mean,
right,
both parties
right.
are guilty of trying to outdo one another. I can tell you where there is actually some concern and action going on politically, it's at the state level. You know, Maryland is the first state in the country to pass a SWAT transparency bill to basically make all the police agencies that have a SWAT team in the state issue these reports with very detailed reports on how often they use their SWAT team and what purpose and whether shots were fired and so forth. And we're seeing there's a bill in the Michigan legislature to do the same thing. And actually there's a bill or a couple politicians in Utah that are going to introduce a bill that will go even farther than that and actually attempt to put some restrictions on the use of these SWAT teams. So at the more local level, politicians are more accountable to, how people feel about their police departments. I think when you vote for your congressman, you're voting for, I don't think most of us vote for a member of Congress thinking that that's going to affect how our local police officers, you know, behave or act or how they prioritize the laws. I think it's usually, we consider that a much more local issue. Now, certainly Congress.
Clinton did pretty well, though. I mean, from a political standpoint, running for president on that community policing, whether or not it actually was executed in the way that it was sold to us. But, I mean, from a political standpoint, I mean, I agree. Obviously, one doesn't necessarily have to operate to the exclusion of the other.
But think about the community policing thing was not, I mean, the reason why it was popular with even, very far left progressive politicians is not because it was community policing. I'll give you an anecdote that illustrates this point. I actually participated in a forum on Capitol Hill that was sponsored by Congressman Bobby Scott shortly after the Democrats took over Congress sometime in the mid-2000s. I can't remember the exact year. But so I gave my spiel on police militarization. And, at the time, the Bush administration was actually trying to phase out the COPS program, because they were cared about militarization, but just, they were trying to phase out a lot of programs. I testified about, I talked about the militarization problem. And during the Q&A, someone asked about the COPS program and asked if we should, refund it because community policing is a great idea. I said, you're right, it is a great idea. But I pointed out that because there were no restrictions on how these COPS grants were used, that, these agencies across the country were using them to start SWAT teams. And Congressman Scott, the chairman of the crime subcommittee, said, are you telling me that our community policing grants are being used to start SWAT teams? And I said, yes. And he said, that's absurd. That's not what we intended at all. And we all had a good laugh about how ridiculous that was. 6 months later, Scott presents his budget proposal to the leadership, which makes it into the House Democrats budget. And it refunded the COPS program at 100% levels that it was during the Clinton administration with no restrictions at all on how the grants could be used by local police departments. So, you know, it's not as if they didn't know, but, you know, when it comes right down to it, Republican or Democrat, every politician likes to put out that press release saying, you know, I just secured $500,000 in federal money for our local heroes in blue. And if you're the one who stands up and says, you know, but there's no way I'm going to let them spend it on a SWAT team, or I'm not going to let them, you know, use it to buy more high-powered weapons. I mean, no congressman's going to do that. They love the adulation they get from securing the grant, and nobody wants to look. I mean, Republicans want to be the law and order party. You know, the Democrats are, in cahoots with the police unions. So there's really no political incentive for either of the two parties at a national level to implement any of these reforms or to talk about how maybe things may have gone too far.
Just lastly, when you see the announcement by Holder yesterday regarding mandatory minimum sentencing for nonviolent drug users, I mean, and granted, we're not talking about a huge cohort of people. The vast majority of people who go to jail under these offenses are doing so under state law as opposed to federal. But is this the type of thing that we need to see happen in terms of changing the culture so that maybe we get to the point where a politician sees some value in saying, we're sending this money back to the district, but we're also going to make sure it's restricted in how it can be used?
Well, I mean, I think to the extent that we are going to give these grants, then yes, we need to put restrictions on how they're used and add stipulations to them. I mean, one thing I talk about in the book is you can't really talk about whether police shootings, like police officers firing their guns at people, have gone up or down, because even though there's a federal requirement that every police agency keep that data, it's just not enforced. Nobody's made the effort to actually enforce the requirement. And you know, every police agency in the country gets federal money in some way or another, and there's no reason why we can't say, if you're going to take this money, you have to be more accountable and transparent. You have to let us know how you use your SWAT team. Let us know how many times your police officers fire their guns, and you know how many times they kill someone's pet. That should be. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we probably disagree on whether these federal funds should be going out at all. But to the extent that they are, yeah, I think we should attach restrictions on how it's used and make sure that, you know, to the extent that we can, they're used in the right way, and that if we can use them to keep departments more transparent and accountable, then that's a good thing.
Are you encouraged by Holder's announcement? I mean, at least in terms of, if not for its immediate practical effects, but at least in terms of maybe this sort of 40-some-odd year now drug war is starting to see some disintegration?
Yeah, I think I'm more encouraged by the symbolism than the practical effects. I mean, you know, the idea that the Attorney General can get up and say some of the things that Holder said this week is encouraging. The defense attorneys I've talked to say that there's not going to be a big actual practical effect in terms of, you know, reducing the population of incarcerated people, or even really reducing the way mandatory minimums are used, or changing, I guess, the way they're used. But just to the extent that that can happen, that an attorney general could get up and say this and there wasn't an immediate, you know, political backlash, is encouraging. And I'll say this, I mean, I think even on the right, you're seeing a lot of movement toward, you know, reform and recognizing the problems of mass incarceration. You've got groups like Right on Crime, which, you know, a lot of sort of marquee conservative names are finally starting to say, you know, maybe we've gone too far and it's time to reconsider some of these things. So, I mean, I think the discussion is ripe for some change. Unfortunately, you know, most of the people who are making noise at places like that are out of office, where they can do so, you know, with some political safety. But I think, you know, if there's a lesson to your listeners who are concerned about this stuff, I would say that there has to be. I mean, politicians are not going to, for the most part, voluntarily come out for reform and say that, you know, our police have too much power. They're only going to start to, you know, move for these changes if it becomes a political liability for them not to. So I'd say that, you know, even though political opinion polls you know, for example, on marijuana, you know, a healthy majority of the country now supports legalizing marijuana, not just medically, but outright. But, you know, in Congress, I think it's like 4 or 5%. And that's because there's, you know, there's still the sense that there's a lot of political risk in coming out to legalize pot. And they don't really see any liability to just keeping quiet about it. So until people start, you know, voting on these issues and, you know, writing your congressman and saying, you know, why are you shouldn't be using, you know, war terms when you're talking about policing our communities, you know, until they feel like there's actual some liability to them propping up the status quo and keeping things the way they've been going, I think it's going to be difficult to persuade any politicians to change. I mean, you know, politicians aren't known for their political courage for the most part.
Right, and I think it's sadly, it's only politicians that can really rein in their police forces.
Yeah, that's really where the response, I mean, that's where it's going to, where the change is going to come. And that's how we got here. I mean, I emphasize in the book that it's, again, it's not an anti-cop book. If anything, it's an anti-politician book. I mean, they're really the ones that set the policies that got us here.
Radley Balco, the book is Rise of the Warrior Cop. We'll put a link on majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Great talk.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the better half of the program. I mean, I think the interesting, you know, sort of, and I didn't want to get caught up in sort of the classic libertarian argument that I get into with libertarians, because I think there's a lot of value in talking about these problems and recognizing these problems without even necessarily getting into an argument about the solution here. But I happen to think that if you can get politicians to stop funding, if you can get the political will to stop funding police departments to fight terror or the war on drugs, you certainly can muster the political will to get them to continue to fund, but put restrictions on how that goes so that the execution of those plans is more in line with what you've sold in the first place. You can say the solution is just not fund these departments, but they're still going to have funds, and you're still going to have, Buffy, Police Chief Buff, who's going to look at those new toys and say, that's what we're going to spend our money on. Because that's the thing that we can show people. You still have your Police Chief Kesslers out there, which is not, I don't want to paint with this such a broad brush, but the point is that I think inevitably, when you charge people with a role in society like being police officers, it is human nature that they're going to be, A, tend to abuse that authority. I'm not saying all, and I'm not even saying the majority, but there's going to be a strain in there. There's going to be that constant tension. Like I say, I put on a cop uniform for a week, and I missed it for like months after that. Just walking around the street, and just people come up to you, and officer, and you just say, well, wait one second. I'm talking to my partner here. You walk into a diner, and they just immediately like, what can I do for you? It felt good. And I'm not saying that necessarily that cops aren't deserved of that type of respect in the community. But then the question is how do you make sure that the flip side of that, the natural propensity for human beings, particularly ones who are attracted to those positions of authority, do not abuse that authority? And I don't think it's simply a question of don't provide them federal funds. I think it's a question of placing restrictions, really explicit restrictions on how those funds are to be spent. And then I think there's also just this broader problem that we have of a war on terror and homeland security. I mean, I think that if you had some uniformity in terms of how police officers are trained, that it were developed on a federal level, you could make transparency that much easier. Why should there just be a transparency in Maryland, say, and not nationally? Which isn't to say that you can't use that Maryland law as the basis of a federal law. And so, you know, that's, I think, where from a solution orientation we diverge. The problem isn't that federal dollars per se were the only impetus to this. It was a whole raft of things. And it's federal dollars that may be the best instrument in which to curtail it. But, you know, we've got a lot of, there's a lot of tides pushing against this, not the least of which the Supreme Court, which consistently favors police authority over civil liberties, it seems to me. But very interesting discussion and definitely something important to be thinking about. And, you know, like I say, when I don't remember what context it was that maybe it was a youth group I was involved in that had this cop come in. I think the cop was a friend of my dad's who was part of the SWAT team, but he was a normal cop, but then they kept the SWAT stuff. And I just remember him talking about, like, no one is allowed to go into my trunk and pull any of this stuff out. And it is criminally sanctioned. I mean, it was always just sort of like, we only go open up this box with this equipment under the most specific of circumstances. And it's quite clear that either on a federal level or a state level or a municipal level, those requirements, that bar to entry into that box full of the SWAT equipment has been lowered and lowered. And I suspect that's happened on a municipal and a state level. So maybe it's time for some broader national, federally emanating requirements and parameters for the use of this equipment. Who gets it and when? All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. You know what we should do? Because I did listen to the program yesterday on my app. I have the beta version of the iOS app and the beta version of the Android app. I didn't listen live because I was putting Saul to sleep, but I did listen. I streamed the thing, and through all sorts of, like, conditions. I didn't download. I just streamed it. Could have downloaded it if I wanted to.
All sorts of conditions.
Oh, yes. All sorts of different environments. I'm not even going to even begin to tell you. I did hear the plea you guys gave at the end of the show. I only listened to part of the member show because I don't go past 90 minutes. When you guys start giving away extra material, forget it. It was, the show was about an hour 48 yesterday, so I didn't listen to those last 18 minutes. I did listen to the closing plea that you guys gave about members, and you should know that the results are in. We lost 2 members yesterday. So you guys may want to up your game a little bit. I will make a plea.
Maybe not.
I will make a plea today.
That makes me feel terrible.
I will make a plea today for new members to show the kids how it's done. We cannot do this show on a daily basis without more of your support. We get cancellations. We look for a 2-to-3-to-1 pace for new members, and we just haven't been there this month. And by month, I'm not talking the month of August. I'm talking 1 month. It's bad news. It's scary stuff. I could spend my time going out and trying to find big money donors who will give the money to the show if I cover their pet projects, but I don't want to do that. So it's really up to you. If you have the financial wherewithal to become a member, do so today. And the rewards will be huge for you. We're going to have an app that's going to be released within a month maximum. And you're going to love it. It's going to be a very easy way to listen to the show. And it's also going to grow the show exponentially, which will then benefit you going into the future. So if you enjoy listening to the show on a daily basis, regardless of how much you listen to on any given day, please, please support the show by becoming a member today at majority.fm. Number 646-257-3920, 646-257 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM or any of our legacy IMs. We'll talk about the definition of independent and outside in a review of our national security state. Also, 2012, one of the warmest years, and one of the top 10 warmest years. Great piece on just how much the cost of state universities has gone up over the past 10 years. And a couple of parting shots on Cory Booker before the end of the New Jersey primary today. I'm going to get to that fracking story, which I never got to last week, I think. And maybe we'll do a random rush. All that and more, 646-257-3920. Back in a moment.